Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
Welcome to The Money Show. It's brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a licensed financial services provider. Mike Brown, the chief executive of Nedbank in studio. We'll chat to him in just a moment. Results out of Nedbank today. Plus, we've got Lord Peter Hain coming into studio. He's our shapeshifter this evening. Peter Hain, a British Member of Parliament for many years. He served under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. And then there was a funding scandal or a funding issue, and he stepped down as a member of Parliament. Now he's Lord Peter Hain, and he's also a lecturer at Wits Business School. I'm looking forward to meeting Peter Hain this evening. Also tonight, lots of stories around collusion, and we see the guys at Stutterfords are being accused of all kinds of nefarious activity when it comes to furniture removals. Stutterfords being charged with 649 counts of collusive tendering. And who were they colluding with, allegedly, or against? The presidency, parliament, the secret service, the police service, national prosecuting authority, SARS, and the Reserve Bank. If you're going to pick a fight with somebody, those are not the guys with whom to pick a fight. So we'll talk to Mel Portgieter. He's the managing director at Stutterfort Van Lines, plus Temo Inkosi Bonakele from the Competition Commission this evening. We'll also find out whether or not you should be worried about the incidence of bird flu. A second Astral farm has been afflicted with bird flu. Colin Cullis on lessons from the world's three richest nerds, and what it tells us about the future when we look at their pay packets. So there's lots to come on tonight's Money Show. Tonight's Fast Fact Question, brought to you by MTN Business. Today's Fast Fact Question, who was Piet Badenhorst? I'm sure there was more than one Piet Badenhorst, but there's one that the Money Show would be most interested in. Who was Piet Badenhorst? If you know the answer to today's Fast Fact Question, you can SMS me on 31702 or 31567, or you can tweet me at Bruce Business. Today's Fast Fact with MTN Business. To protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
If you thought having a banking license was an automatic passport to printing money, today's Nedbank results will tell you a different story. South African banks are massively profitable, but they're seeing those profits come under pressure. First half profits for Nedbank showed a small decline of nearly 3%. Chief Executive Mike Brown with us. Your South African operations grew by inflation plus a little bit, around 7%. But it was the Ecobank stake that you have which sort of pulled you back.
Yeah, good evening. And I think that's exactly right. Our results are really a story of two chapters. Our South African businesses, which is where probably 95% of our capital are deployed, grew by around about 7%, so just slightly ahead of inflation. And I think we had a pretty solid performance in a very difficult political and economic environment. And then our investment in ETI continued to underperform. It's not really new news to the market. ETI announces their results. They're a public company. We account for them a quarter in arrears. So actually, the ETI numbers that we speak about today are their numbers from March. So they've already told the market those. But that reduced our overall growth rate from around 7% to the minus 3% number that you spoke about.
If memory serves, you were quite wary about taking up. You had a preemptive right on 20% of Ecobank. And you waited till the last minute and there were some governance issues and you weren't going to do it unless the board was changed. And the board was changed and you took up your 20% stake. Do you regret it now? Is there more stuff in there that you wish you'd known about?
Well, I think we certainly didn't anticipate that the oil price would collapse as much as it did, and as a consequence, the Nigerian economy would go into recession, which has really been where ETI's major problems have been. I still remain quietly confident that when we look back in 2020 or 2025, because certainly investments in the African continent are long-term investments, sure, we will look back at this being a good investment that, if we'd made it slightly later, would have been an even better investment. And, you know, from our point of view, you can see if you read through our numbers, we've appointed Brian Kennedy now to join Mfundo Nkuhlu on the board. So Nedbank now has two directors on the ETI board. Mfundo is about to take over as chairman of the ETI risk committee. So we're very definitely working alongside the ETI board and management team, rolling up our sleeves to get on and fix the business and, you know, generate value, given that right now this hasn't been a good investment in the first
couple
of
years. I mean,
you're
putting your two most senior executives after you, essentially, in those important positions within ETI. It's that serious.
Well, we don't rank any of our executives, but...
Okay. I mean, but, well, two people who might think that they are the most important executives after you within Nedbank. These are two very senior executives within Nedbank, two very experienced old hands within Nedbank.
That's exactly right. So this is something that we very definitely want to fix. And, you know, actually results and share prices, you know, share prices generally move ahead of what's going to happen in the future. And interestingly, ETI's share price year to date is up about 60%.
Okay. So, I mean, signs of an improvement there, because you made the acquisition at a time of the Africa rising narrative, and the oil prices damaged so many African economies, and they're quite possibly not going to be, oil's not going to be rushing back to $100 a barrel anytime soon in the environment that we're in. $50 oil looks like where it's going to stick for a while. So African economies are going to struggle.
Yeah, I think it is still going to be tough in the short to medium term. But, you know, if you take the IMF projections for Nigeria, for example, you know, they go from minus 3% recession that Nigeria has been in last year, going back to growth rates of around 3%. So not back to the 7 or 8% growth rates, which was $100 a barrel growth rates. But at 3% growth rates, I think you'll find that our investment in ETI performs well.
What about South Africa? You say in your results that you're positioning for recessionary environment, you're positioning for downgrades. We are in what they call a technical recession, two quarters of contraction. Are you anticipating it's going to get worse and that the downgrades of our sovereign debt and rand-denominated debt is going to happen and that the environment is going to become more and more treacherous in which to do business over, say, the next year?
I always find it quite interesting when you say we are now in a technical recession. Actually, you know, the economists measure things backwards. So by the time they tell you that you're in two quarters of recession, you're actually in the first quarter being perhaps out of recession.
We don't know that yet.
So our outlook is that the economy for the full year this year will grow at 0.6%, having shrunk in the first quarter of this year. So that does mean that we expect it to be slightly better.
Okay.
But, you know, I think that in the current political environment in the lead up to December and elections, there's going to be an enormous amount of political noise, policy uncertainty, all of which is bad for confidence and investment. So I would expect, you know, still very low levels of growth, although slightly better than the first quarter.
Did the Reserve Bank make a mistake by cutting interest rates recently, considering the potential risks that you outline in your results to the economy? Are they not going to be sort of almost forced to start raising rates again if we do get a bit of a blowout in the currency and see the inflationary impact of that coming back again?
Yeah, so our base case is that we will not have the local currency downgraded in the second half of this year, and I would imagine that's probably the Reserve Bank's base case as well, in which case I think that they didn't make a mistake. We've seen inflation come off quite significantly. We've seen less pass-through of the slightly weaker rand into inflation. So I think that the 25 basis point cut is sensible in those circumstances, and if we don't get a local currency downgrade, we'd expect that there would probably be one more cut this year and maybe another cut or two early next year. So probably each of 25 basis points, so a total of 100 points of cuts in the cycle. If we do get a foreign currency down, a local currency downgrade, then I think we will very definitely see a depreciation in the rand and rates rising, or certainly not cutting, going into the next couple of months.
Yeah, it's an uncertain time to be doing business. It really is. I'm chairing a conversation tomorrow at the Big Conversation in Cape Town, Daily Maverick's Big Conversation. It's about business and it's about media and it's about whether or not business should be having a bigger voice in the media. You can't avoid politics nowadays. The CEO initiative has become embroiled in politics and trying to work through the complexities. You've been very involved with the CEO initiative, and Jabu Mabuza has told us how everybody in the CEO initiative sulked after Gordon was fired. How are you feeling about the CEO initiative and the environment in which we're finding ourselves in cooperation with government to try and get ourselves out of our malaise?
Well, I think in the first instance, the CEO initiative is all about trying to do things on a project basis that are good for the South African economy, good for growth and good for jobs, irrespective of any political leadership noise. So things like the SME fund, which is now fully funded with 1.5 billion rand of private capital in it and is likely to start deploying that capital in the second 6 months of this year. The youth employment scheme that Stephen Kosoff and Colin Coleman have been working on is progressed enormously, and hopefully we'll be able to announce some progress on that in the second half of this year. So I think these are really important things for all South Africans, irrespective of any political noise. So clearly, the fact that the recall of Pravin from the roadshow overseas triggered the foreign currency downgrades was a snub for the CEO initiative, and we're working on trying to regroup, reset the relationships of working with government. But I very definitely think for the sake of all South Africans, it absolutely isn't something we should give up on.
No, it's absolutely imperative. I mean, there is also the sort of action you've got to take as bankers, as lenders, for example. If you see something going awry in the economy, you need to take steps. So banks, for example, withdrew banking facilities from the Gupta family, and it's becoming increasingly apparent why that happened 12 months ago. And then we saw reports last week that the banks were instrumental in forcing the hand of Lynn Brown and the National Treasury and the Finance Minister, Molusi Gigaba, in the suspending of the Eskom FD. Were you part of that?
So we don't really comment on exactly what happens with any of our customers or clients, but inevitably in any business that hasn't been well run or is being corruptly run, businesses run out of money. And generally before businesses run out of money, they will breach all sorts of financial covenants that they have with their bankers. And that would cause, depending who those covenants are with, banks to intervene and make sure that a different outcome happens.
In the same way as if a private car, if an individual with you had a bond of R1 million and they were running up credit card debts of 200,000 rand and they were buying big flashy cars and things and came to you to extend that loan, you may say, actually, we'd like you to pay it back a little bit sooner, for example.
That's a perfect example.
Yeah, it's exact. So when companies behave badly, you treat them like you treat individual customers. When we look at it in terms of the environment in which you're operating, how you've been CEO now, what, 10 years?
Only seven.
See, only seven. God, I thought time was flying. I thought it was longer than that. I mean, you're still having fun.
Yeah, it's still, I think it's an enormous privilege to be the leader of an organization like Nedbank. Obviously, it's a difficult economic and political environment to be operating in.
The hardest you've had to face so far?
Yeah, it's definitely the hardest we've had to face. I think it's harder than the global financial crisis right now. But at the same time, there's some just enormously exciting things that we're busy with. In particular, the managed evolution refresh of all of Nedbank's technology.
The management, you've just lost me. You sound like you went to Harvard for a month and went on a course.
Managed evolution. So sorry to use that term. So really what we've been doing is deliberately refreshing Nedbank's technology step by step over the last 3 or 4 years. We've probably got 2 or 3 years to go. But increasingly, that refreshed technology is going to evidence itself in our customer propositions. And that's where it really starts to get interesting.
I mean, when we look at the massive success in acquiring customers that Capitec has had, for example, over 9 million customers they say they've got, and I know there are different ways of counting customers. But the big advantage they've had as a startup bank from the early 2000s is everything was squeaky brand new. Older banks have had bits of bubblegum and sticky plaster sort of keeping systems together, and this is precisely what you're going through now, is to modernize that technology.
Exactly right. So, we already now have a significantly better digital personal loan and transactional capability, which is effectively what Capitec have been so successful in being able to deliver. In the next 6 months or so, you will see a new private bank wealth app and a new Nedbank retail app, both of which I think will be absolutely exciting. And by the time we get to the middle of next year, a refreshed customer loyalty and rewards program from Nedbank.
How long is it going to be, if I was a Nedbank customer and I wanted to borrow some money, that I could just click on an app and say, borrow, and an artificial intelligence will approve the loan in a nanosecond?
Well, I'm not so sure about the nanosecond, but right now we are the only bank that you can do a mortgage application completely online, end to end. And we're seeing significant increases in volumes there. So right now, about 10% of all of the mortgage volumes coming into Nedbank are end-to-end digital.
Are you still giving people mortgages? I mean, one looks at the property market flatlining. I mean, particularly in smaller towns across the country, Joburg's property market generally has flatlined quite badly.
Yeah, our mortgage book in, versus June last year grew about 3%. So we're still very much giving new mortgages to customers. So we've now got an end-to-end digital process there. And we've got an end-to-end digital process in our personal loans environment.
But it still requires people to go and do the credit checks and all of that sort of stuff.
That's exactly right. But, over the next couple of years, as we complete this managed evolution, last time I'll use that word on this show, we will be a completely digitized business in the front end of our retail environment. If people choose to do that, or people could still choose to transact with us through the branch environment or through our call center environment.
And fill out mortgage forms with a pen. Ugh. Mike Brown, Chief Executive of Nedbank.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management. You get R1,000. You can either put it into any bank on the JSE, but you have to buy one of the big six banks, because now we can call Capitec a big six bank. Where would the R1,000 go, Chris Stewart?
What's the time frame, Bruce?
6 months and then 5 years.
All right. On a 6 month basis, I would put it into Standard Bank.
Okay.
Still, despite the recent outperformance.
Mm-hmm.
On a 5 year view, it's going to be a toss up between Capitec and First Rand.
Okay. So Nedbank's not featuring in your picks then, despite the fact that they do a lot less wrong than all the other banks seem to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've seen results out of Nedbank today. You've seen results out of Barclays Africa Group, and I can't wait till we can start calling them APSA again because it rolls off the tongue so much easier. We've seen those both in the last couple of days. Nedbank would claim, I guess, that the results were reasonable for the items that are under their control. I guess one could say that the, you know, what's gone on at Ecobank is not necessarily within their control, although they did voluntarily go out and buy 20% of the company a couple of years back. And, you know, the core business is symptomatic of everything that's going on at the moment. Very, very slow activity levels across the business, not much by way of asset growth, but the things that they can control. Cost control reasonably good, and credit quality coming out to save the day, as it did with Barclays Africa Group's results yesterday.
When we look at the environment in which these banks are operating, they are operating very fine businesses in a very challenging environment and are still amongst the best rated banks in the world. I mean, these guys are boxing way above their weight.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the financial services system in South Africa is a national asset. I've said that many times before. We have well-run banks. We have a relatively concentrated banking system, which, while some people wishing to promote competition may say is a bad thing, I think the banks are very, very competitive. But by virtue of a relatively oligopolistic environment, that creates a fair degree of stability as well. And adding to the stability is an excellent regulator. We've got a great central bank in South Africa. They've done a great job in supervising and regulating the banks over the years. And as a result of that, you know, it's a huge asset. It's an asset massively underutilized right now simply because people aren't doing anything in the economy. And we all know why that is. That's because there's no political confidence, there's no political certainty, and a lot of people sitting on their hands, not wanting to borrow, not wanting to invest right now, and that's impacting hard on the banks.
And it's extraordinary that how, I mean, again, it's a complicated process, but how it would almost be like waving a magic wand. Whatever would restore the confidence, if that confidence was restored, people would then go, oh, actually, I would like to upgrade my home. I would like to renovate. I would like to build a business. I would like to import something. I'd like to export something. And the banks would then come to life.
Yeah, I mean, there'd be a lag, I guess, because part of the lack of activity is a lack of affordability, certainly in terms of the retail market borrowing. But that lack of affordability is, you know, a direct consequence of a lack of job creation, negative real income growth, by and large, and some balance sheet repair from the excesses of 2007, 2008 still taking place. But, you know, if employment creation came back, people started experiencing real salary increases, balance sheet would repair, confidence would return, the bank's willingness to lend would probably increase as well. And that's really the tragedy of what's going on at the moment. If you look globally, the global environment is improving. Global growth seems to be recovering in a relatively synchronized manner. Commodity prices showing some robustness. All of the tailwinds would be in place for a strong rand, no inflationary problems in South Africa, policy rates being cut, and the ability for people to go out and borrow and spend and invest. But unfortunately, the parlous state of local politics is putting a lid on all of that, and we're standing out very much as the underperforming emerging market globally right now.
We are, but it won't take much to turn it around. This might be a bit before your time, Christian, but our fast fact question with MTN Business this evening, I asked, who was Piet Badenhorst? Did you ever deal with Piet Badenhorst when you were a youth?
Yeah, you flatter me, Bruce. I do remember Piet Badenhorst. I never dealt with him. He was before my time.
Well, he was, you see. Now, he was the first Mnet multi-choice PR guy, says somebody in the SMS line in Cape Town. I think he may come back and haunt you for that one. But he's the guy who created APSA. He used to run United, and then he brought together Volkskas, United, Allied, and Bancorp, and created OPSA.
Did you forget Trust Bank?
And Trust Bank, of course. He brought Trust Bank into the blend there as well, and that was Amalgamated Banks of South Africa, and he was the guy behind it. He pulled it all together.
Yep, that's right. As I said, I didn't have many dealings. Mine was more of a Donny Cronier and Nally Bosman type era. So I'm a young man, Bruce, don't you?
Of course
you forget that sometimes. But yes, he did pull the whole thing together.
Yeah, he's died at the age of 80 in Australia. By all accounts, he was quite a difficult guy. A former senior executive at APSA once told me about how Piet Badenhorst was in a lift and there was a guy with a ponytail in the lift. You can tell me whether or not this is probably true, Chris Stewart. Piet Badenhorst followed the guy with the ponytail out of the lift on the floor that he got off at, followed him to where he worked and said, "You work here?" He said, the man said, "Yes." He said, "Where is your manager?" And he said, "There he is over there." Called the manager over and said, "Either by this time tomorrow this guy's had a haircut or you're fired," to the manager. Piet Badenhorst sounds like he was a bit of a tough customer.
The other stories. You can get away with that nowadays, Bruce.
I don't think you could get away with that nowadays. And because if you want to have decent technology, of course, you have to have people with ponytails in the business. Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management. Piet Badenhorst, the guy who pulled together APSA from the disparate group of building societies and banks, United, Volkskas, Allied, Bancorp, and of course, Trust Bank, pulled them all together, created APSA. But he got fired within 2.5 years of starting APSA. He was replaced then by Donny Cronier, who made way for Nally Bosman, who then made way for Steve Boyson, who then made way for Maria Ramos, who still runs APSA to this day. Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management.
The Money Show.
Truth or Bull, brought to you by 10X Investments, undoing the myths around your retirement savings so you get more money when it matters most. We're going to need an answer to this particular question. I'm going to go to Rico first in Blackheath. Is that truth or is it bull, Rico, that if you have an investment at 1%, it's 2% less than the industry average?
It's truth.
I'm afraid not, Rico. It's a trick question. It's a trick question, Rico. You got caught out, I'm afraid. It's a 2 percentage point reduction. It's a 2 percentage point reduction, but not a 2% reduction. Nikki, truth or bull?
Bull.
Well, how did you know that, Rico? How did you know that, Nikki? How well done to you. By default, Nikki gets the answer bull. It is a trick question, but by paying 1% rather than 3% it's like paying 1 rand rather than 3 rand. It's actually a 66% saving. You're paying 66% less than you would if you were paying 3%. So I'm afraid it is, Rico, a horrible, nasty, vicious question, but the correct answer to that was bull. Congratulations to Nikki, who has won $1,000 in a 10X unit trust. Find out why less than 1% in fees means for your retirement at 10x.co.za. And join us same time tomorrow for another opportunity to win 1,000 rand in a 10X unit trust.
Hi, I'm Sivngesi, and sometimes people think I'm joking even when I'm not. Like when I say that ending up with 40% less at retirement isn't funny. I've sworn about it on radio. I've pointed out that the real swear words are high fees. If you still don't believe me, why not get hold of 10X for a free comparison? SMS compare to 448-44 and find out how to end up with more money when it matters most. I'm dead serious. 10X Investments is a licensed financial services provider. T's and C's apply.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a licensed financial services provider. Coming up on the next Money Show, personal finance expert Warren Ingram on how to invest in low-cost index tracking investments overseas. The brand new squeaky clean chief executive at MTN, Rob Shooter, talking about data prices, the company's financial results, and TP Njonjo, the chief executive of the country's state bank, the Land Bank, well, one of their banks, also taking us through the company's financials. We're going deep into financial results season.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
Are you concerned about bird flu? Are you frightened about bird flu? Should you be at all worried about bird flu? So far, so good in terms of transmission of bird flu from birds to humans, but chicken producers taking no chances when their flocks are affected. Astral recently slaughtered thousands of birds at one of their breeding sites at Villiers due to the outbreak of the H5N8 strain of bird flu. Today, the company revealing another outbreak, this time in the Standerton district, where one poultry shed out of 48 on that particular site is affected. Gary Arnold is Managing Director of Agriculture at Astral Foods. He's on the line just from Centurion this evening. Gary, just how big a deal is this second outbreak of bird flu?
Good evening, Bruce. Bruce, the second outbreak of bird flu at this present moment is obviously a concern to us. following the first outbreak that Ashley experienced. At this stage, though, relatively small in perspective to the first outbreak we had, and at this point, under control to some extent, Bruce.
Okay, so under control, one shed. Can I call it a shed? I think I can call it a shed.
Yeah,
one out of 48 on a farm is affected. Now, how do you contain it? I mean, if it goes to a second shed or a third shed, do you then have to slaughter all the chickens in all 48 sheds just to be absolutely safe to make sure that you eradicate the virus? How do you do it?
Yeah, Bruce, there's obviously generally accepted methods of stamping this virus out. Typically, worldwide, a very aggressive protocol is followed where the virus is identified. The affected poultry site would be killed out, depopulated. That is obviously to prevent further spread of what is a highly contagious virus. Containing the virus, perhaps I can reflect on our first incident. The farm that was involved there, let's call it Villiers, a space just outside Villiers. We still do have poultry on that site. The farm is under quarantine, but we did manage to keep it out of other sheds, poultry sheds. So in this instance with Velverduct, we're looking to learn from our experiences there, and we'll hopefully contain it to the specific shed or site that has been infected, Bruce.
I mean, but it can result in thousands of birds being slaughtered. I mean, it's a brutal job. But if you don't do it, the risk of it spreading throughout an entire population of chickens and then leading to international sanctions on bird populations is a reality. One has to make sure that these outbreaks are contained.
Certainly, you know, in the absence of any preventative measures to control this disease, and this disease is new to South Africa, I think we're all aware of the impact it's had in Western Europe. That's been widely reported on. And then the two outbreaks in Zimbabwe recently that have also been reported on. So in South Africa to date, including this outbreak, 11 confirmed cases. The industry does have a responsibility to manage it well. To stamp it out when it is apparent or when it is confirmed. But Bruce, we need to look at longer term sustainable solutions, and I think you'll see from our press release today, one of those does involve the vaccination programs.
And that's an important process that has to be undertaken. Is there risk to human beings as a result of these outbreaks of bird flu?
Bruce, with H5N8, no, it hasn't been demonstrated to infect humans. This is a highly virulent virus in domestic poultry. So, you know, it is carried by wild birds on migratory routes. It doesn't affect certain types of wild birds in terms of the illness that it exhibits in those birds or mortality as it does in domestic poultry. It's highly aggressive towards domestic poultry, and we typically see high mortality in birds that it has infected.
Gary Arnold, thank you, Managing Director of Agriculture at Astral Foods. In a moment, we'll talk to the Competition Commission about the biggest case of collusion and price fixing that the Competition Commission has ever seen, 649 cases against one company, against Stutterfords. We'll also talk to the company this evening here on The Money Show.
Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter, at Bruce Business.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. I'm Bruce Whitfield. Well, furniture removal company Stutterfords has been charged with 649 counts of collusive tendering. It's in relation to hundreds of government tenders issued for furniture transportation, and includes tenders by, amongst others, the Presidency, Parliament, the Secret Service, the Police, the National Prosecuting Authority, SARS, the Reserve Bank, the Department of Justice, the Public Protector, as well as state-owned enterprises and private companies. Stutterfords faces the largest number of charges for a single company in the history of the Commission's anti-cartel enforcement. We'll talk to Mel Portgieter from Stutterfords in just a moment, but first, Temi Nkosi Bonakele, the Commissioner at the Competition Commission. This is a big one, Temi Nkosi. Good evening.
Good evening, Bruce, and listeners.
I mean, this is a huge one. It is the biggest one in your history.
Yes, it's quite big. It's quite this seems to have been very prevalent, and of course, I should say that it's the value of the contracts. If you look at them one by one, are not all big, but the conduct was very pervasive.
I mean, 649 charges is significant. No company acts by itself. You can't collude by yourself. You say this has been going on since at least 2007. You highlight Stutterford, but who else is in trouble here?
Well, we've got a couple of them, some of them lesser well-known names, JT, Retief, Transport, Cape Express, Removals, Patrick Removals, and DeLange Transport. But some of these firms actually have come forward and settled with us.
Okay, so you're pretty convinced that you've got a strong case here, so much so that you've referred it to the Competition Tribunal. Just clarify something for me, please. 10% of the company's annual turnover on each of the 649 charges. That's not 649 times 10% of annual turnover, because that would bankrupt the company. This is just 10% of annual turnover of Stutterford that you're looking to extract as a fine.
Yes, 10%, if you like, multiplied by over 600 times, which is multiplied by the number of offences.
Okay, but I mean, this could bankrupt the company, couldn't it?
That's right, yes, but that's the one of the consequences that you face if you are involved in so many transgressions. So I agree with you, the consequences can be disastrous.
Isn't this the toughest you've been in any single case? I mean, we've seen applications for 10% of group turnover, but not 10% for each and every single individual case of collusion.
Yes, partly this is us upping the ante, because there's nothing stopping us in law that for each transgression you are involved with, you are liable for 10%. So if you are involved 649 times, you are liable 10% 649 times. So yes, it's about upping the ante, it's about deterrence. I should say that we've also invited these firms, understanding really how big the prosecution is going to be. We've invited them to come and propose how they should we should move forward with this. Some of them responded positively, except for Stutterford.
Timu Nkosi Bonakele, the Competition Commissioner. Thank you. The General Manager of Stutterford Van Lines, Mel Portrieta, listening to that. Will you cooperate, Mel, or will you take the risk of being put out of business by the Competition Commission?
Well, absolutely, Bruce. Good evening to your listeners and yourself, Bruce. Obviously, this has come as a great shock to us today. We haven't even received the bundle from the Competition Commission. We were still waiting on particulars. I think what your spokesperson said is absolutely incorrect, in that we've given every piece of cooperation to the Commission. We have conducted internal audits. You know, we battled to substantiate the 649 charges, and perhaps once we see the bundle, we'll know what he's talking about. In some of these instances, Bruce, I don't mind telling you that it would be a simple matter of, and it seems like this has happened historically, is where a client would ask, you know, who else is quoting, or can you provide us with an additional quote? You know, we would ask the client, refer them to other companies. And if the other companies are mentioned, it seems like they would consider the Competition Commission at this stage would seem that is an anti-competitive charge.
Is it fair to say that you haven't fully comprehended the impact of the competition laws, and that you may be guilty, whether by omission or commission, of breaking competition laws? That's what it sounds like.
You know, Bruce, look, this investigation has been ongoing now for quite some time, and I can assure you, sir, that as we stand today, the entire Stutterford brand is fully, fully au fait with the entire Competition Commission Act. And so, you know, we sign codes of conduct when we're employed, and so if any member of our staff is found to be behaving in an anti-competitive manner, they would be summarily dismissed. There's a zero tolerance at our company for any anti-competitive behaviour. So I would probably need to concede that historically, maybe, you know, and how long back this goes, I think in our fraternity, in our household removal fraternity, there was
less than competitive behavior.
This goes back to 2007, and they say they've got evidence. The other parties in these collusive relationships have owned up and have done deals with the Competition Commission. If you don't do a deal with the Commission, you're going to get 640 times 10% of your annual turnover. It is what will drive you out of business. Even if they can prove 10 counts, that'll be 100% of your annual turnover. You'll be done.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Bruce. You know, and it's sad because, you know, there are, you know, to my knowledge, as we stand today, there are about 69 companies in the household fraternity that have been implicated in these charges. The fact that we've asked questions and haven't just stepped up to the plate and said, right, we're guilty, you know, we ask questions. We ask questions of the commission, which, you know, our legal counsel have been wrangling with the commission upwards and down. And like I said, we haven't received the bundle back from them yet. We just wanted them to substantiate some of these because, you know, so that we also could obtain a clearer understanding as to what they are looking for and what we've done, because I can assure you in the last 6 years at least, I would be hard-pressed to find one incident in this company.
Yeah, but I mean, if anybody was going to collude and you were going to collude in tenders to do with the presidency, with Parliament, the Secret Service, the police, the National Prosecuting Authority, SARS, the Reserve Bank, the Department of Justice, the Public Protector, I mean, you'd have to have your head read.
Yeah, absolutely, Bruce. That's not something that, you know, I can't comprehend. As I'm speaking to you now, I can't comprehend how we would do that. We've got systems, procedures, and you know, things in place that prevents that sort of thing. You know, it's a clear cut system. There's tender processes going out there, and we submit to one entity. So we don't understand how all this has come about. To be honest,
Mel Bolthither, thank you, General Manager of Stutterford Van Lines, innocent. He says, Temu Nkosi Bonakela says, they've got evidence and they've got other people who've blabbed. That's the way these competition processes worked. And Mel Bolthither taken by surprise by the by today's assertion by the Competition Commission to have 10% of annual turnover on 649 charges. That's 6,490 times annual turnover. That's what they're going for. It could kill the company if they're found guilty. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a licensed financial services provider. Lots of you coming out this evening very angry, saying, oh, the Competition Commission, that's idiotic. Your guest needs to go home and work out a reasonable settlement. We can't have people jobless because Thembi Kile wants to show off his power. I've changed the wording there slightly. Please forgive me. Thembi Kile is using the full force of the law. Thembi Kile Bonakele, the Competition Commissioner, and using it to make an example. It's irresponsible in the extreme, says somebody else. Then somebody else, Stutterford, says Henry is suicidal. Fighting with regulators is like fighting with SARS. There's only one winner. Colin in Pretoria says it would seem to me that the Competition Commission is trying to extract a bribe from Stutterford. It's not a bribe. It's a fine. It's the way the system works, and the system is designed to dissuade anybody from colluding. And these investigations are going back 10 years to 2007, and there's a huge amount of pressure being brought upon Stutterfords, and they are being taken aback by the severity of the ruling today. And yeah, we'll watch the space very closely. I'm ratcheting up the number of lords that I'm interviewing. I've done Lord Mervyn King. He was great. He had a nice book, The End of Alchemy. And I've got Lord Peter Hain. He's outside our studio, a real lord, but he's not wearing the ermine, you know, the furs and stuff. He's wearing a very nice jacket, very nice trousers, and he looks like a regular guy. South African born, well, Kenyan born, South African parents, and he is a lord, he's a peer of the realm. He's Lord Peter Hain. Looking forward to catching up with him and talking about his work at Wits Business School. Have you ever stayed at an Oberoi hotel? I've been told they're very, very smart. They're very, very nice. That's why I haven't stayed at one. I won't judge you, provided, of course, you paid the bill yourself. I'd love to know what an Oberoi hotel is like. How do I know about Oberoi hotels? Well, many people linked to the Gupta leaks have been wined and dined at the Oberoi Hotel in Dubai, the latest being Lynn Brown's former PA. The hotel group, founded and headquartered in Delhi, was founded in 1934. It has 33 locations around the globe. And we're talking later about the dangers of doing your boss's job with or without them knowing, and how you get thrown under the bus if you're caught. All of that coming up on tonight's Money Show.
The Money Show. Business Unusual.
Business Unusual with Colin Cullis this evening. Colin Cullis, Forbes magazine has been publishing rich lists for decades. And it's really, it's quite interesting when you look at over sort of decade by decade or year by year, you see trends and you see how the world is changing. You see how the world is evolving and you see which industries are making the billionaires. And I suppose 100 years ago, it would have been oil and railroads. And today, it's nerds mostly, isn't it, at the top?
Yeah, three of the five most richest men in the world have made their money from specifically technology related to the internet. But you're right, back in 1987, 30 years ago when they first created their list, it was just a sort of a top 10 then that they published, and they listed that they believed there were 140 billionaires in the world. That's when the world was 5 billion people. Fast forward to this year, though, they have 2,043 on their billionaire list in a world with 7.5 billion people. And the reason I'm raising it in part because it's the 30th anniversary. The most recent list came out in March this year. But Jeff Bezos moved to that number one spot just at the tail end of July when the Amazon figures came out.
For an hour and a half.
Indeed. In fact, he is currently sitting as having shed $154 million since the 27th of July, which is kind of sobering. But it still leaves him at number three, putting Bill Gates back to number one, a position he has held for 18 of the 23 years he has been on the top of that list. Quite impressive. But it started off, it was kind of real estate, I think, was the inform sort of industry. And Japan were the players. So in 1987, four of the top five were all from Japan. The richest man in the world then had $20 billion. That was Yoshaki Tsutsumi. And he stayed there for the next 4 years until Bill Gates came in and said, right, Microsoft is the way forward. Let me take over. And Bill Gates has done really well right up until 1999 when he had topped out his highest he'd reached then was $90 billion. The following year, he lost $30 billion. That's the dot-com crash. The amazing thing is, he was still the richest man in the world after having lost $30 billion. It really is quite incredible how the numbers do work in that regard. And looking at some of the others, so South Africa, we've got eight billionaires on the list now. The first was in 1994. Harry Oppenheimer was the first to join the list. I must point out, though, that Forbes don't include monarchs and, you know, people who look after the country's wealth or dictators. And I'm not 100% sure exactly how they go about deciding who is or isn't one. But that's those are excluded from the list. So if you do go through them at some point, you might find, hang on, there's somebody missing there. So there's eight South Africans, all are men, only one is black. But okay, not bad. We've got about 55 million people in South Africa. So 8 billionaires on the list is, I suppose, not the worst thing. Just going back to that dot-com bubble, that crash, that saw 83 billionaires lose their titles. But it wasn't the biggest fall-off. The rise and fall, how you look at the rich list, you can tell how the world's economies work. Well, that was 2008, 2009. $4.4 trillion worth of assets held by the billionaires in 2008. There were 1,125 of them. The next year, only 793 remained, their assets half in value. Seriously, quite big losses. In terms of commodities, and certainly in terms of Russian commodities and oligarchs, they started coming through in 1997. Currently, Russia, the third most populous city for billionaires. There are 73 who make Moscow their home. Number two is Hong Kong, 75 living there. And New York, understandably, is at 82. Donald Trump is one of them. He is on that list and has been on there for quite so many years, although he has been right off it as well and then come right back on. So quite impressive how he does it. The biggest winners, the greatest climbers, despite the U.S. sort of being the most numerous on the list since it started in 87, that would be China. They first started rising up through the list in 2006 where they passed the 100 mark. They're now sitting at well over three times that. 316 billionaires now come from China.
And now, all of these trends are really interesting, but what are we learning about the future from the current trend? That three out of the top five billionaires in the world have made their money in technology, and they've made that money in an indecently short period of time. In the last, in the case of Bill Gates, in 3 decades, in the case of Amazon, in the last 2 decades, in the case of Mark Zuckerberg, in the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, so Mark Zuckerberg is a classic example of just how crazy this trend and how quickly it has come through. Bill Gates, you can understand, there was a long, slow growth for Microsoft. But the internet companies certainly have been meteoric. And Mark Zuckerberg joined the top 10 last year at age 32, the youngest anybody on that list. In fact, for the top five there, everybody else is sort of much, much older than that. So it is quite impressive. There are 56 who are under 40 that are billionaires. The youngest is 21. But that wasn't from some internet startup. That was dad being really generous and donating a very large chunk of his wealth to a daughter. It's kind of hard to say for sure. I'm tempted to say that because real estate and manufacturing and finance still remains one of the real steady ones. There's a big group of people in the middle who are all in finance, banking, and investments who are doing really well. And to be fair, most of the people on this list's wealth doesn't come from them actually holding cash, but the perceived value of their companies that allows it to move up and down so rapidly. So it's hard to say that they will stay the darlings in the future, but possibly some form of new technology. I didn't get through all 2,000 on the list, but I counted up to 10% all this technology has been having how they've been created. And they separate telecommunications and media and broadcast from those. So technology has certainly grown as a segment. I imagine it'll remain there. I can't see any reason why it would drop down, but you'd probably start seeing some specialization about those. I do have some short biographies of the top five, if you'd like. I'm trying to find some things that maybe you wouldn't have known about them.
Okay, in a moment, sure. Colin. I wonder if anybody's ever going to be able to do the research as to the impact that these billionaires have had in terms of the number of jobs they've created, the number of opportunities they've created, and how the great innovators of the world have made their billions have changed the world for good or otherwise, for example.
So that is a fantastic question, and I jumped off from the Forbes list, which kind of does a ranking thing and a definition thing, but Credit Suisse put out one that looked at dollar millionaires in the world, and that gives you a much better indication because they called that kind of a wealth report. And I've always taken that when people talk about the 1%, you know, the super wealthy, that it was about 1%. As it turns out, when you work out the number of dollar millionaires, let's say that's the starting point, not that it is necessarily the cutoff, that works out to 0.43%. Of the global total. There are 32.6 million millionaires in the world, which is a pretty big increase. 20 million since 2000 have been added, most of those from developing economies. And what they point out is they say, while you see the super wealthy growing at a significant rate, the amount of inequality hasn't shifted so much. It's just that you can count somebody once they pass a million mark, where it's kind of difficult when you separate through all the others. So the issue was then, okay, but what proportion of the wealth do they manage? And then that gives you some indication to say, is it getting a little more spread out? Well, for the millionaires, that is a little more spread out. But for the billionaires who represent, and this is a difficult number for me to pronounce, the billionaires represent 0.00027% of the global population. They possess 7.67 trillion of the global wealth of 256 trillion. So, in effect, they control 2.99% of the planet's wealth. I can't say, and they're not necessarily saying, you know, inequality, they're saying, is not changing, but certainly how wealthy people are getting is kind of tricky. I can say, in terms of somebody making a difference for not holding on to that money, then the top five are kind of encouraging for what they've done. And this is the giving pledge that Warren Buffett sort of came up with in 2009. And of the top five, three of them have signed up to the giving pledge. Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Mark Zuckerberg have all agreed that they will give away at least half of their wealth. Warren Buffett has the world record for the greatest charitable nation, which in 2009, I think it was, he gave 10 million Berkshire Hathaway shares to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which at the time was valued at $30 billion. And of course, that moves up and down as the numbers go.
But I mean, it's absolutely huge. Colin Cullis, thank you with Business Unusual this evening. And it's really good to see the philanthropists giving away their money. You can't take it with you, so you might as well do something useful with it while you're alive. And more billionaires are coming to terms with that idea, but still far too many for some reason are still playing the game of holding on to the money for as long as they possibly can.
The Money Show.
The Big Five.
The Big Five brought to you by Worksman's Attorneys, your legal specialist for success for the last century, keeping you close for 100 years. Visit worksmans.com. Well, personal assistance. If you've ever had to deal with an executive's personal assistant of both the public and the private sector, they wield considerable power. They're generally very intimidating individuals. They often act on behalf of their bosses, mostly with the knowledge and the sanction of their bosses. But there will be times where they might either know the answer to a question or be able to craft a reasonable reply in their boss's stead. And it's all well and good while everything is going well. When the wheels come off, however, the fallout can be quite spectacular. And today we saw the Public Enterprises Minister Lynn Brown ask her personal assistant to resign following allegations that she had dealings with the Gupta family. Now, according to the latest Gupta emails, Brown's personal assistant, Kim Davids, had been instrumental in making key decisions, including the selection of new board appointments to state-owned enterprises. You can't make this stuff up. You really can't. In 2015, crucial appointments of officials sympathetic to the Guptas were made, and Davids was apparently involved. So is the minister throwing her PA under the bus? It wouldn't be the first time. Remember Bruce Kolwane? Bruce Kolwane went, he took the fall for the now infamous Watercliff landings. And of course, he's ambassador to the Netherlands nowadays. Tonight's the big five things that could get you fired, especially in an executive assistant point of view. The labor law specialist with Maseru Mule Attorneys, Lispuke Maseru Mule, on the line to us from Johannesburg. I suppose in the case of the personal assistant, they're taking quite a considerable amount of risk doing the job they do. They're the gatekeeper, they're the access, and sometimes there's the plan B for the powerful executive, Puke. It's a big job.
Hi, Bruce. I'm afraid I missed a little bit of what you said. I only had it now.
No, I'm just saying, with personal assistance, as in this lady by the name of Kim Davids, who worked for the Minister of Public Enterprises for Lynn Brown and is accused of taking all kinds of liberties in the name of the minister, it's probably not that uncommon in the world of executive assistants.
No, Bruce, look, you know, the fact of the matter is that professional assistants, executive assistants, as they are called, like most employers, are required to always act honestly in relation to the employer. And what they need to remember all of the time is that the boss is not the employer. The employer is the entity which employs both the professional assistant, executive assistant, and the boss. So if you do anything, either at the instance of your boss or in order to please your boss, which is inconsistent with your obligations to your real employer, you get into trouble.
And that is the risk that anybody faces, of course, because the moment you think that you're doing the right thing by your boss and your boss will have your back, they might have your back and they may just be the person who sticks a knife into it.
Absolutely. I think the problem is that a lot of employees do wrong things because they are afraid that if they speak out, if they say no, that their jobs may be at stake, that they may not get bonuses, that they may not be promoted. So they tend to keep quiet and hope that nothing comes of it, out of it. But as happens in a case like this, unfortunately, at times, things do come up into the open, and then the employee is faced with the consequences of his or her own actions.
I mean, I suppose there's some pretty obvious things for which somebody could be fired. I mean, things like theft or fraud, for example, negligence. If you are a truck driver and you drive the truck into a wall and you were careless in doing it, well, yeah, that's probably a good reason to be fired. Sexual harassment is increasingly being seen as a good reason for firing somebody. Racism, particularly in the South African environment, is seen to be a cause of sacking. I'm surprised that something like gross insubordination, which is something that sort of strikes me as very 1970s, very militaristic. There's a charge of gross insubordination. It sounds almost like you're in the army, but maybe the workplace sometimes is a bit like the army. But you can be fired for standing up to your boss and saying no.
You can be, and you'll be surprised how often it happens. I think the issue is that both in the public service and in the private sector, that there are times when employees feel that, look, you know, who are you to tell me what to do? And they answer up to their bosses in their faces and simply refusing to do what they're supposed to do in a very insubordinate manner. Probably believing that if they get fired, there's the CCMA, they can always go and complain, and who knows, they might be reinstated. But the law still requires of a junior employee to be obedient, believe it or not, and to comply with all lawful instructions and not to be insubordinate towards their superiors.
And then that's where it becomes interesting, especially in this particular case of Kim Davids and Minister Lynn Brown. It is complying with legal obligations. It is following the law. And as an employee, you might only be, you know, 18 or 19 or 20 or 21. It might be your very first job, but you've got to know the law. You've got to know what you can and cannot do, what is legal, what is illegal, what's moral and immoral. And if you're given an instruction that is contrary to the law, well, you've got to stand up for yourself and you've got to say no. In that case, in which case you get fired for gross insubordination.
Well, if you do, at least you're guaranteed that you'll be reinstated if you challenge the dismissal.
Sure.
I think the point to be made is that if you're given an instruction and you can tell that the instruction is clearly unreasonable, it's unlawful, you have every right to say no. You have every right to drop your boss an email and record the fact that this instruction which you have given me cannot be complied with for the following reasons. But of course, the other problem for employees is that there is almost a rule that if you are unhappy about an instruction from your employer, at times you should comply and lodge a grievance later. But the problem is that employees tend not to refuse to comply with unlawful instructions, or if they do, they don't then record the fact that, look, I was unhappy and lodge a grievance with whoever may be the person in a more senior position than the one who gave the instruction.
I mean, are the authorities who, what are they called again? Oh, the guys who you go to complain if you get fired unfairly. Oh, my mind's just gone blank.
Yes. You go to the CCMA.
CCMA, there we go. The CCMA. Are they being kept as busy as they were in the past, or are South Africans beginning to come to terms with the labour laws, South African companies coming to terms with the labour laws? Are we seeing fewer or more cases to the CCMA?
My experience is the CCMA is as busy as it's ever been, and people are standing up to their rights. They go to the CCMA. They challenge, at times, not just termination of employment, but they challenge final written warnings. They challenge employers when they don't get promoted, and they challenge employers when they believe that they have been demoted because their responsibilities have been taken away. So there's certainly more awareness and not less, and the dispute resolution institutions are pretty busy.
I mean, how many cases go in favor of employers versus employees?
Wow, that's a tricky one, Bruce.
What's your sense of it? I mean, are there lots of spurious claims that get taken to the CCMA, which actually are wasting the CCMA's time, or are people generally winning their battles?
Well, a fair amount of people win their battles, but there's still a lot of people who go to the CCMA because, one, their employers don't probably want to spend the whole day sitting in the corridors waiting to be called as witnesses, wasting time. So even before the case gets heard, it gets settled, 2 months, 3 months salary. Or at times, because the employer takes a position of principle, the case does get heard and the employee gets kicked out. But I think on the whole, Bruce, I wouldn't say that there is massive abuse of the CCMA system. I think employees go there by and large believing that they have been unfairly fired, and at times they succeed, at times they don't.
My thanks to you, Puke Maserumule, the labor law specialist at Maserumule Attorneys. Quick question for you before we go to Eyewitness News. I'd like an answer, please, on 31702, 31567. Which British civil servant has retired today after 22,219 engagements? 22,219 engagements. A high-profile British civil servant, aged, I think, 95 or 96, has finally retired today. Who is it?
The Money Show. Shapeshifters.
So I asked you just before we went to Eyewitness News, I said to you, there's a civil servant. He's 96 years old. He's been working for 70 years. And he's just performed his final public function as a civil servant. Marion in Camps Bay in Cape Town. Who is the civil servant to whom I refer?
Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh.
He's retired today after 22,219 public engagements. An extraordinary career supporting the Queen. Marion, well done to you. Peter Hain, Lord Peter Hain, he is a South African by birth, but born in Kenya, which I was surprised to learn. We'll talk about that in just a moment. He ended up as an anti-apartheid activist in the UK when his parents went into exile. He ended up serving in the governments of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. He is now Lord Peter Hain. Have you ever met Prince Philip?
I have a number of times, yes.
I mean, he's such an interesting character. And I use the word interesting reservedly because he is the last, I mean, Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary of the UK, somebody else whom you will know.
Indeed.
Former Mayor of London described.
Don't think much of him.
I'm sure you don't. The last of the anti-PC brigade has retired. They don't make them like that anymore.
They don't, no. And Prince Philip is certainly one of those. But he's been an absolutely faithful consort at the Queen's side, and it's pretty extraordinary.
Do you find him quite offensive, though? I mean, he pretty racist views from time to time and putting his foot in his mouth from time to time.
Let's put it this way. He's from a different era.
he's from about three different eras ago, yes. But he has been a remarkable civil servant. I mean, and effectively, the royal family are civil servants.
There's no question about that. And so, I mean, I'm not a monarchist, but so has the Queen, whom I know and have worked with as a cabinet minister, and she is extraordinary. And I do always, when I'm with her, find that she has an incredible sense of humour.
She's 90.
You wouldn't necessarily expect because she's quite sort of po-faced in public, but she has a great sense of humour and will always laugh and be ready to engage in. And in fact, I'll give you an example. When her private secretary was retiring, quite a long-standing private secretary at Buckingham Palace, I was invited along with my wife Elizabeth, and he gave a little speech saying he found it very difficult to get this date because Her Majesty's diary is so full, to which she pipes up and says, "And whose fault is that?"
Good, so
everybody fell about laughing.
I mean, it's a wonderful experience that you're having and that you've had growing up in the United Kingdom from your teenage years. But you were born in Kenya. Mum and dad had a job in Kenya.
My mum and dad were both South African born. My dad in Durban, my mum in Port Alfred. And he went to Wits University and got a degree in architecture. And his first job was in Nairobi. And so they flew up in an old Dakota, and I was my mum was pregnant with me, and I arrived while they were there, but they were only there a year or so. So my entire childhood was spent in South Africa, most of it in Pretoria, and that's been the formative period in my life, which is why a lot of my heart is still in the country and why I come back as often as I can.
Like Elon Musk, you went to Pretoria Boys High, and unlike you, his heart isn't in the country at all. I mean, he had a terrible experience at Pretoria Boys High, and you had quite a fractious childhood in growing up in South Africa. Your parents were very political and politically aware and politically active in those days.
Yes. I mean, Pretoria Boys High, in my view, is the best school in the world. I thought it was a terrific school. And I don't know where you went, Bruce, but I bet
not Boys to Pretoria High, Boys High.
I
not
bet Boys High was better. It was an ordinary state school in my day. It's obviously more exclusive now, and multiracial, which is great to see. One of my first experiences was being woken up as an 11-year-old and told my mum and dad had been put in jail when we were in Pretoria, and they were arrested.
I've gone all cold. I didn't realize you were that young.
They were arrested they were supporting Nelson Mandela's defiance campaign. And they were arrested in a township and outside Pretoria when they were discussing their plans with black activists and held under the then 12-day without charge, detention without trial law, which subsequently became 90 days, 180 days, and then indefinite. But they were one of the first couples to be detained under that law. And my dad was sacked from his job. And then a few years later, my mother was issued with a banning order, which, of course, restricted you. You couldn't take part in politics. It meant even that she couldn't attend my young sister's, who was about four at the time, birthday party.
Yeah, because you might have consorted with other
four-year-olds.
Certainly
with four-year-olds, but more than one other person was the bar. Couldn't come and talk to our teachers at school. So we brought up in that environment. And by the way, one of the clauses in the banning order, as you may remember, was that banned people were not allowed to communicate with each other. So they banned my dad a year later.
So your mom and dad couldn't talk?
Well, they were the first married couple to be banned, and the government was hugely embarrassed, so they had to insert special clauses in their banning orders.
It's no laughing matter. It's no laughing matter, but it's laughable.
It is, and allowing them exceptionally to communicate with each other. And then things got worse and worse, and they banned my father from... They stopped all the architectural firms in Pretoria, the municipal area to which his banning order confined him, And he couldn't
and
leave.
He couldn't be, and then nobody could employ him.
No could employ him, so he had no alternative but to go into exile, which we didn't want to do.
Did you have to sneak out of the country? Or?
No, we got a one-way exit permit.
They were just happy to see you go.
Yes, though they watched us board the train at Pretoria Station and travel down to Cape Town to board the Union Castle liner, which we then did. It was the cheapest way to travel. Friends raised the cost of the travel. So we went to London and started
with
a
nothing?
New life. Virtually nothing. A friend put us up there.
Did that make you a very angry young man?
I don't think so. I don't regard myself as an angry any sort of thing, really. Although a lot of, I do get cross at injustice and so on. But no, I don't think so. I don't think I went there as an angry young man. And then a few years later, however, I mean, to be honest, I was more interested in seeing my brother and I's favourite football team, Chelsea, play on the first weekend we arrived than I was getting involved in activity. But I started going with my mum and dad a few years later to the anti-apartheid movement events. And then, as a sports fanatic, a young, ordinary white South African, all sports fanatics, I came up with the idea of stopping Springbok tours and cricket tours by running on the pitch and other forms of non-violent
diet. I mean, that would have been the time of Basil de Oliveira, of course, because B.J. Forster at the, 1970s?
1968.
68. That's a lifetime ago for some of
it
us.
Is.
He said Basil de Oliveira is not welcome to come and play in South Africa because it would be awkward having him change in the same change rooms and hotels.
Well, it would have breached the law, wouldn't
and
it?
And it would have breached the law, so prevented the English team from coming, and that was the beginning of the end for sports, and that was the sporting sanctions, and that was the era in which you were involved.
Yes, that caused such offence to middle ground opinion in Britain that it swung opinion very decisively against South Africa. Though, on the back of a few months after that, Forster had banned that cricket tour. The MCC, which was the cricket authorities at the time, English cricket authorities, actually issued an invitation to the South Africans to come and tour Britain in 1970. So, and I read about this, and I was so cross, then I was angry and outraged after what had happened to Basil de Oliveira, that I then got together with friends, issued a public statement, says we're going to stop this tour by taking direct action, and I was the first to do so. I didn't expect to be leading the campaign at the age of 19. I thought I'd be a foot soldier and more sort of exalted people would do it, and suddenly I was propelled into the leadership and found myself quickly becoming what was called public enemy number one here in the South African media, and pretty hated by a large section of the community in Britain as well.
I mean, ironically, Forster was a sports fan, and he was, I think, quite taken aback by the ferocity of the response. But anyway, let's move on from that.
Yeah.
It got you into politics. You joined the Liberals. That was your first sort of political
outing. The Young Liberals.
The Young Liberals.
Very radical at the time.
And you then switched to Labour.
Yes, I was always a socialist, not of a nationalise everything kind, but of what I still am, a libertarian socialist, empowering people, industrial democracy rather than nationalisation and so on.
So you're not a Corbynite today?
I'm not a Corbynite, but he surprised everybody.
Extraordinary performance in the
result that we as a Labour Party got just a couple of months ago in the general election. And Theresa May, you know, started off being a strong leader, ended up being a weak leader, and described as a dead woman walking by her former cabinet colleague, the Chancellor George Osborne.
I mean, she had a 17-seat majority in the House of Commons. She bet that she would get a 100-seat majority to drive through a hard Brexit. Britain, after voting for Brexit, went, oh, we don't like this very much, let's go. And Jeremy Corbyn going to rock concerts and shouting through a megaphone and suddenly becoming Funky Jeremy and hanging with the hipsters, suddenly got the youth vote and came very, very close to usurping the Conservatives.
Yes, I mean, I don't know how close we did come. We're still about 60 MPs behind, and it's under a first-past-the-post system, but it did extraordinarily well. Whether it is well enough to win on that agenda and under his leadership next time is an altogether different question. But certainly, well, it reflects, you see, I put it in a similar category to events of the past year, Brexit, followed by Trump, followed by Macron, followed by the general election. There's a kind of popular revolt against the political class in the advanced old industrial economies of Europe and America.
And it's not all necessarily a good thing. I mean, one looks at the United States and
I don't think Trump's a good thing at all.
No, he's terrifying.
And I think Brexit was a disastrous thing, and it's going to damage Britain historically, irreparably, in my view. But these events are more, as I say, about popular outrage against the political elite.
Mark Cork says, my father might have taught Peter Hain at Pretoria Boys High, plus minus 1962 to 1965.
It could well have been.
Michael Cork.
Michael Cork, I think he did.
There we go, Mark Cork.
There were other teachers. I had a wonderful teacher. I was asked who was my favourite teacher when I was a cabinet minister, and I said Terry Ashton, who taught me English at Boys High and was absolutely great. And I remember him saying in class once, we were trying to get our heads around what persona non grata meant.
Mum and Dad.
He said, Hain's parents are persona non grata with the government.
Good. Well, you see, you get practical input in the classroom at an early stage. My guest this evening, Lord Peter Hain. Question for him, does he know Lord Bell? Could he pull some strings and get us an interview with Lord Bell? He keeps saying no. Peter Hain, more from him in just a moment.
The Money Show. Shapeshifters.
I want to get on to what Lord Peter Hain is doing now in just a moment. But you did politics and economics, and then you went to Sussex University. Did you cross paths with Taubo and Becky while you were doing your masters, or did you miss each other?
We missed each other, though I knew and worked with him in London in the anti-apartheid movement. But one person I did was there at the same time as me was Rob Davis, the industry minister.
Oh, really? Was he a good student?
He was doing a PhD, I think, in some obscure,
Davis,
obscure sort of Marxist, Althusserian Marxism, I think, which is very egocentric or idiosyncratic, I thought at the time. I'm friends with Rob. In fact, I sat on a plane next to him coming up from Cape Town on Tuesday morning, so we had a good old gossip.
A good catch-up. Do you know Lord Bell? I mean, you both sit in the House of Lords. You wear red robes and have ermine collars, and you are the ultimate. You're a bit like a constitutional court in South Africa, I suppose. You can veto laws. You're powerful people.
Every law that goes through the House of Commons, the primary chamber, has to go through the House of Lords. It's the secondary chamber because it's not elected, as I think it should be, by the way. I think it should be. And I never expected to end up there. My party leader asked me to go there, Ed Miliband, because he thought he'd be prime minister and he wanted reformers and he wanted people like me to lead that. But I can't say I bumped into the venerable Lord Bell, though I know him by repute as an ardent Thatcherite, an advisor to Tim Bell, to Margaret Thatcher, and of course the head of Bell Pottinger.
Well, now he left last year and is now distancing himself as fast as he possibly can.
There's a lot of people
from the mess that has been created by Bell Pottinger in South Africa. I mean, as a South African who's wanted the best for South Africa from your young days, going into exile in the United Kingdom, possibly wanting to come home and now teaching at Wits as you do, I mean, are you as outraged as many South Africans are by the shenanigans that Bell Pottinger has got up to?
I am, and much more. I found out a lot more about it in this week or so when I've been teaching as a visiting professor at Wits Business School. And I've talked to a lot of people and realized how poisonous Bell Pottinger's role has been in completely. Fake news has been their speciality. The truth has been turned upside down. And I'm so angry about it because I think what it has done is played into a lot of the rhetoric surrounding political debate in South Africa in a totally dishonest way. This phrase, white monopoly capital, the truth is the people who funded Lord Bell's ex-company, Bell Pottinger, actually are examples of monopoly capital.
Of the very worst kind.
Of the very worst kind, corrupt. Cronyism at its heart, and that is the cancer at the top of South African society at the moment, which dismays me as a former anti-apartheid activist. So what I'm going to do about it, or try to do about it, is raise this in Parliament when I go back.
In Parliament or in the Lords? How would that work?
Well, the Lords is part of Parliament.
Yeah.
I will seek to find means of raising it through questions. But I'm also going to make representations to the regulatory authorities for public affairs companies in Britain, because I think Bell Pottinger has broken just about every rule in the book.
Yeah.
I think it should be shouldn't be allowed to do any business in South Africa anymore. I don't know whether it's working for other companies and businesses here, and I think it should be put under a lot of pressure in Britain as well.
And a lot of people would support you on that. How did you get the Wits gig? Did you get a phone call one day from Wits saying we'd like you to come and teach?
Well, I had wanted for some time to make use of my experience of 12 years in government, including negotiating the Northern Ireland, an end to the Northern Ireland conflict.
And that was sort of through John Major's sort of process, and then Tony Blair became Prime Minister in 1997.
That's right, the Good Friday process and so on. Things like that. Yeah. I'd acquired a lot of experience in government in 12 years as a senior minister, most of it, and in my life in politics. And I wanted, you know, all this experience and expertise, I wanted to kind of give something back. And the opportunity came from Wits Business School following a meeting with the Deputy Vice Chancellor of the university when I came out to receive the ORT Tambo National Award for contribution to the freedom struggle in December 2015. And I was then introduced to Wits Business School, and they thankfully jumped at the opportunity of me being a visiting professor. So I teach MBA students in leadership, in negotiation, in media, and things like that. And so far, it's been a fantastic experience.
What sort of commitment do you have to give?
I've come out for about 10 days on this time, so I take time out from what else I'm doing, usually in the House of Lords recesses, though it may not always be the case in the future. Because you're much more flexible than you are as an MP. And I find it really stimulating. I say to people, you know, whatever else is happening in South Africa, however depressed and I am about the terrible leadership the country's got at the moment, and the terrible state of the economy is a result of that leadership, direct result of it. You go and teach young Master of Business Administration students at Wits Business School, and there's fantastically dynamic, talented young people who are the future of the country, and it gives you hope.
And it does give you hope. I mean, when one meets in the business world, one meets in the civil service, fantastic South Africans who want only the best for the country. Yet we've got to go through a very painful and tortured political process. We've been through painful and tortured political processes Indeed. In the past. One just hopes that this one doesn't wreak as much havoc as the previous transformations have.
I hope so too, but it's got to happen.
Yeah.
There has to be change. The ANC has to change or it will die. And I say that as an ANC supporter of long standing. And the government has got to change or South Africa, the Rainbow Nation of Nelson Mandela, will just be a distant legacy, a distant dream. It's got to change. And, you know, what dismays me is those at the very top seem almost impervious and indifferent to the consequences of their corruption and cronyism on the economy. When you reduce a once successful, thriving parastatal like Eskom or South African Airways to virtually bankrupt organizations, that may be overstating it in the case of Eskom, but not SAA, in the case of SAA, that is an economic crime.
Mike Brown, chief executive of Nedbank, just across the road, and was sitting in that chair an hour and a half ago, and I said to him, so the banks are pushing back. I mean, lenders are saying to companies like Eskom, state-owned enterprise, we can't keep lending you money if you employ the sorts of people that you employ. And as a result, the government's been forced to act and suspended the finance director. We know Brian Molefe, the chief executive, and the boomerang chief executive, is gone.
Yeah.
There is a pushback.
And I think there should be more of it. And one of the things that gives me hope is that there's a strong civil society in South Africa in the way there never was in Zimbabwe, which allowed Mugabe to become the monster that he did. And that's what gives me a lot of hope. And there's also lots of good people in the ANC who are putting up a fight. Whether they can succeed or not by December, I don't know. But I hope that the business community will become more assertive as well. Because the business community, if you remember, and you will know even better than I do, it was a business community in the late 80s, on top of everything else that was going on, that really did pull the plug on the end of apartheid and say to the government, look,
you can't do this anymore.
You can't do this anymore because the economy is going into free fall. Well, we now have a, not exactly an action replay, but we have a...
There's similarities.
A very similar situation where the economy is in trouble, not because of the underlying strengths of the economy. I mean, the infrastructure's good, the financial regulation's good, there's an independent judiciary, all of that. That side of it's good governance, but because of bad governance politically.
We need confidence. And that confidence will come with political change.
And economic stability. And you cannot have economic stability when you have a government that is and doesn't care about the consequences of its decisions. And I'm afraid that's what we've got at the moment.
Lord Peter Hain, I thank you so much for coming in this evening.
It's
really nice
to
meet you. Visiting professor at Wits University, Lord Peter Hain, former Member of Parliament, former government minister in the Blair and of course, the Gordon Brown governments in the United Kingdom, now sits in the House of Lords, and he's going to be making Lord Bell's life a little bit awkward in the House of Lords. I can't wait to watch that one.